The House Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. And so I'm going to ask the guy who sat here the longest, was here before some of us today, Representative Petersburg. You get a chance to look at the minutes, and would you care to make the motion?
I do approve the minutes of the January 23rd meeting of our committee.
Okay. Representative Petersburg moves approval of the minutes from the January 23rd meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, the motion prevails, and the minutes of January 11th are approved. Oh, 23rd. Okay, sorry, 23rd. All right. So, and I'm a little bit under the weather, so we'll see how long I can last here. But luckily, we're going to let Judd and Nick do much of the talking. So, except for the questions we ask. And I assure you we'll have questions.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I was told there'd be no questions today.
One of those.
So we'll have to get back to you on that. Anyway,
okay,
thank you,
very
Madam
good. Yes.
Chair.
Please give your name for the record and do proceed.
Yep. My name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and we appreciate being here today. We will be before the committee, I believe your next two committees as well, to talk about our regional wastewater system. We're going to talk about our Thrive Plan, but for today we're going to talk about the Council's role in transportation planning and our relationship with MnDOT and how all of that works. And I'm happy today to have Mr. Nick Thompson with us. Nick is relatively new to the Council. Many of you may recall Arlene McCarthy, who was our Director of Metropolitan Transportation Services. She retired last year, and Nick has come on board, and so he is going to walk through the planning activities of the council, and between the two of us, we should be able to answer any questions that you have. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nick.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Thompson. Please give us your name for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nick Thompson with Metropolitan Council. So I'm going to give you a comprehensive overview today of the transportation planning process in the region, foundation for it, how we work with partners, and some of the products of the transportation planning process. So the two roles that the council has, primary roles that the council has in transportation, is in the planning function, serving as the region's federally required metropolitan planning organization, or as I'll refer to quite a bit through this presentation, the MPO. We perform the long-range transportation system planning for all modes in the region, but we also manage the shorter-term federal transportation funding program, or TIF. We also have a key role, as you know, in transit operations, providing and operating transit systems and contracted services. Structured, just as a broad overview for the Met Council, three main functions. Within transportation, we have the Metropolitan Transportation Services, which is the lead on the transportation planning, and also Metro Transit are the two functions where transportation is dealt with. So now on the transportation planning front, the authority for transportation planning comes from both state and federal laws. At state law, it's through the Minnesota Land Planning Act, which has designated the Met Council as the planning agency for all long-range transportation planning. And we make sure we coordinate our transportation planning with MnDOT, with our regional and local partners in counties and municipalities. At the federal law, also, that plays a key role in our transportation planning and planning processes. We have the Metropolitan Transportation Planning Act, the NEPA, Clean Water and Conformity Act from 1990, and then Title VI Environmental Justice Law, which guides a lot of our planning and outreach. At the state level, from state transportation planning, we must adopt a long-range comprehensive policy plan for transportation. We call this the TPP, or the Transportation Policy Plan. It represents two of the four required regional system plans. That's the surface transportation planning and the aviation planner within the TPP. The other two required, which we won't talk about today, are wastewater and parks. So the TPP provides us the guidance for the transportation system in the region and for local comprehensive plan development by cities and counties. We look at the local plans for consistency with the TPP, and with other regional system plans. The Transportation Advisory Board, or TAB, is established with 34 members, and this is comprised of both elected members from cities and counties, agency representatives from agencies that MnDOT, PCA, MAC, Met Council, citizens that apply for and are appointed for positions on TAB, and then representatives of the modes, including freight. There are 34 members, and I'll talk about who they are specifically. The TAB itself allows us to fulfill the federal requirement to have local elected officials that participate in selection of federally funded projects, which they, in the process, they just completed their selection in the past week for the next round of federally funded projects. They recommend a slate of federally funded projects, and the council concurs or denies that slate of projects.
Mr. Thompson, if
yes.
I could. So when you say federally funded transportation projects is what they're involved in, does that include, is that a time when we include transit under the definition of transportation? Or is a transit, you know, selection of those projects and under a different process?
The selection that they are dealt with, and we'll get into detail, is the federally funded set of funds that are federal only that are both highway and transit projects and bike and pedestrian. So it's a mix of the transportation modes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we'll go into more detail here as we
get into
the presentation.
So we thought we'd list to you today who are the current members of TAB. The membership does change in terms of the actual members. But I won't read the names off to you, but you see that the city members are appointed by Metro Cities, except for St. Paul and Minneapolis, which appoint their members. The county, each of the seven counties in the metro region, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Ramsey, Hennepin, Scott, and Washington, appoint members and alternates to the board. And then we divide the metro region into districts. Then we have citizen representatives from each of those districts and agency members as listed.
And Madam Chair, one point to make is with how the TAB is constructed, there is a majority of elected officials to the appointed officials who serve on that then make the recommendations for those, how those funds should be distributed before they come to the council.
Mm-hmm.
Just
put
that in the back of your head.
Within the TAB structure of that board, there are supporting committees that do work and develop the plannings for the TAB to make recommendations. One of the key committees is the Transportation Advisory Committee, or TAC. This includes representatives, again, from the seven counties, 12 cities, and 11 agencies. And because, as we'll talk about the region of the MPO, it now includes a representative from Wright or Sherburne area. These are staff from these agencies that provide a lot of the technical analysis and input into the process. They review projects that are submitted, and often in the federal distribution of funds, they are the members of these agencies, staff, are the ones that are scoring and helping the TAB define what are the highest priority projects. So there's a continuum of transportation planning that you need to think about, starting with the regional development framework. The current one is called Thrive MSP 2040. That's what sets out the vision for the region, not just transportation, but the vision for development in the region, economic development. And then within that, it's supported by policy plans like the TPP that I mentioned, and system statements that helps the local planning officials and local cities and counties develop their comprehensive plans to fit the system plans for the region. The local plans are updated every 10 years, and they're about to start that process to complete their local comprehensive plans in 2018. So many of the cities and counties are already underway for updating their comprehensive plans.
And Madam Chair, just to mention again that next week we'll be before the committee to give a broader presentation on the Thrive 2040 plan, to go back to when we adopted it in 2014 and the process that goes through of the system statements and how the cities bring their plans forward into the comprehensive planning process.
Okay, great, thank you.
So now I want to go into a little bit more about the MPO, which I mentioned earlier, and the federal, how that derives from the federal requirements. So what is an MPO? It's federal law that kind of designates all regions with populations greater than 50,000 people. There are 402 MPOs across the United States, including 8 regions designated with MPOs in the state of Minnesota. And they're scaled MPOs, so the larger you have a structure, they have a little bit different structure. And with those being over 200,000, like our region, has a transportation management area designation federally. And the TMA helps define how you meet federal air quality requirements. The MPO's primary planning functions are to carry out the transportation planning process for the region, produce the required planning documents, which we'll talk about what those are, assure that there's actual coordination of transportation plan and planning among the entities within the region. As we mentioned with TAB, they have a role with allocating federal funds to the region. And then there's a strong role for public participation in the transportation planning process that flows through the MPO process. The Metropolitan Council is the MPO for the Twin Cities region. The structure of the council predates the 1991 federal law requirements, which really put a lot of definition around MPOs. Federally, the Met Council has been recognized and acknowledged as the region's MPO. This question has been asked before. It's been reaffirmed by USDOT in 2011 and as recently as February 2016. That the Met Council is the region's MPO. As part of the MPO, you have to go through a certification process every 4 years, and we are just in the midst of completing the most recent certification process as the MPO for the region.
And Mr. Thompson, if I might, so there was the deadline, I think, on public comment on the current recertification, and has that been received yet? I mean, they officially recertified MPO, Met Council?
Madam Chair, at this point, that certification is not complete yet.
All right, thank you.
We are awaiting the decision.
Right, but I think it's fair to say, Madam Chair, that we don't anticipate that there will be a problem.
No.
It's just a process that you go through as far as that recertification. We've done it many times since the council was acknowledged as the MPO.
Thank you.
So the MPO defined by the federal government creates the urbanized boundary that actually, since the last census, extends that MPO boundary a little bit beyond the seven-county region of the Met Council.
And Mr. Thompson, if I might, yes. there was a recent December 15th ruling, wasn't it, from the federal government saying that this MPO and others, of course, needs to extend its boundaries to include what is anticipated to be the 20-year expansion of the metro area, the urbanized zone. Is that correct? I mean, do you know, we haven't had a chance to talk about it, you may not have either, but, you know, just do we think it's going to be, is it imminent, I suppose you could say.
Madam Chair, the boundaries have extended beyond the seven, and we expect them to, in the 2020 census, expand again as the region's growing. It's including Wright and Sherburne County, portions of that, and also portions of Wisconsin.
And Madam,
Mr. Shetland?
Madam Chair, just to make it feel a little bit better, those boundaries only apply to the MPO function, that federally mandated transportation planning function. It doesn't give the council broader authority related to all of our other operations beyond the seven-county metro area, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. So, Mr. Thompson, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you look at the on the map here is the seven-county region and shaded in light tan. In 2020, this was the area designated as the MPO for the region, the urbanized area, or 2000. And then in 2010, that area expanded. So if you go back to 2000, you see it within the seven counties. And as you go to the 2010 urbanized area from the census, it expands into Sherburne and Wright County. So with that expansion in 2010, we needed to create a new agreement with Sherburne and Wright counties and how we would do transportation planning. So we all sides agreed to a memorandum of understanding in 2014 that really specifies how we'll do the transportation planning, the roles of the the MPO in that process for both planning of transportation and programming of transportation projects that need to be part of the transportation improvement plan. We meet annually with Wright and Sherburne County representatives. They, as I mentioned, they have a member staff on the TAC in the process, and that process started in 2014, or the agreement was effective in 2014. So if you look at overall the transportation planning process, stepping way back, the purpose of it, really identifying what your needs are in transportation, establishing the goals to meet those needs, what strategies you will implement in your transportation plan, and how you prioritize the investments within the region given the funding sources and the expected revenue over time. It's really a planning process around the funding that's available for transportation. It establishes both your conditions on the ground, but also kind of that future and how you build your transportation system to that future that you're set out to achieve. This planning process is the first step in the process that eventually leads to the development and construction and operation of transportation projects. And all throughout the planning process, the goal is to have multiple ways of input into the development of the plans for the region.
And Mr. Thompson, if I could just go back to that. So this identification of needs, goals, and priorities, is that some of that language in statute as to how that happens and what, say, currently might be the priorities?
In terms, Madam Chair, especially in terms of what the statute, what the priorities are, or what the needs? The needs are developed through the planning process, public input, evaluation of system performance over time, if that answers your question.
Mr. Thompson, I think I'm, you know, does the statute at all lay out what would be considerations for, you know, key criteria in identifying needs, goals, priorities?
Madam Chair, if I can just ask a question here. Trying to get at your question. Are you asking that related to assumptions related to funding, or are you asking that related to who is weighing in related to what gets included? Because there's a strong public participation process that we work with our regional partners as they bring forward their plans. But if you're talking about funding, then there's a different answer for that.
Right. I mean, it might be a little of both. I mean, is there anything in statute that guides, Mr. Shetland, how you lay out the priorities in your transportation plan?
No, Madam Chair, not in statute laying out priorities. I think priorities come from a variety of ways, from public input to funding, what's available to conditions of existing systems and priorities for example, preservation of existing systems versus expansion of systems. Mm-hmm. And that comes through a variety of processes that are from public input, funding constraints, programs, mm-hmm. related to any of the modes of transportation.
Okay, that's good. Yes, Representative Barr?
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is probably a related question, but wasn't that partly what the purpose of TAB was, to provide input? Are they considered public or elected, or how are they considered in that process that you just discussed?
Madam Chair, TAB is a mix of both elected officials and public citizens and staff from agencies. They are a clear input into the process, transportation planning process, identifying needs and setting strategies and investment priorities. They are one of the roles in that process.
Follow up, Representative Barr?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. So here it says that the council must establish an advisory body. So is that in statute?
Madam Chair,
yes. State statute.
If I may, one more. Thank you, Madam Chair. So one question that I had, and if you said this, I apologize if I didn't catch it, but when you talked about the folks that comprise that, you had a list of city members, county members, citizen members, et cetera. How do you ensure that it truly is regional, not overweighted in any one particular area when you're selecting, and where is that the requirements of the TAB, again, in statute?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Representative. So the statute defines the membership of the counties, the number of elected officials from the cities, and then the citizen representation and modal. If you look at the city representatives, Minneapolis and St. Paul are always represented as cities, and then the other city members are appointed by metro cities. Through their process, they appoint the members to TAB. So how they choose what their priority for selecting city members.
Madam Chairman? Chair and Representative, just to be clear, Metro Cities is an association of metro area cities. I know some of the members from greater Minnesota may not understand that, but it is a group outside of the Metropolitan Council who then have their own independent way of appointing the city membership to the TAB. So that is one way of ensuring that there is a different set of eyes on who gets to sit on the table. Having the seven county representatives, one member from each county, also ensures that that is being addressed as part of the TAB process and that recommendation process of moving those federal funds through our region.
My last question, I promise. So for the citizen members, how do you determine those? Are they based on, you know, one representative from each county, or is there another input process?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are districts defined in my council, eight districts. Citizens then apply based on where they live. They have to live within the district that they are, and then they go through an interview process and are selected and appointed.
All right. Representative, the other bar, Bar C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With all the talk of TAB, with the what looks to be imminent dissolution of the TAB board?
No.
That's CTAB. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So how does that fit into this? Because the CTAB is all that uses all your county stuff, too. So where does that fit into all of this?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members, CTIB is a funding, we'll get into some of that in the funding if
they don't get in the planning.
Representative Barr, go through the chair, please.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barr.
So they don't get into the planning at all?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Thompson.
Member, they are a funding partner, so they are a part of the process for identifying the transitways and funding the ones that are a part of the plan. Our plan the transitway plan reflects their plan also. So we're in coordination. That's, a stakeholder that we plan with, but they are a funding partner for transitways, which are adopted into the transportation plan.
So I think for members who are getting this for the first time,
mm-hmm.
you know, your head's going to explode, I think, with all the different entities that are involved. So
yeah, there's a lot.
I can appreciate the
Madam Chair.
Mr. Shetnan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to be clear, with the transitways that are funded through CTIB,
mm-hmm.
there is a statutory requirement that says that those funds that they collect have to be consistent with the transportation policy plan. So they are working together.
Mm-hmm.
So there is not they don't have a separate plan for transitway mm-hmm. projects. It is, they have to be consistent. That was done back in 2008 when they were put together. As far as the financial impacts of the potential dissolving of CTIB, that's a different story, and we can talk about that in a little bit more detail, Madam Chair, but it doesn't have such a big role in this because anything that CTIB does have to be consistent with our planning.
So, yes, I think, Mr. Thompson, why don't we continue to go on here because maybe this will be apparent. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there are required planning products at the federal level. The TPP, which I mentioned, I'll talk a little bit more in depth about that. Transportation Improvement Program, or TIP, which is that short-range capital program. Our annual work program, or UPWP. And then we are required and implement a public participation plan for the planning, transportation planning in the region. The TPP is your long-range plan for the metro area. It's required under state and federal law. We prepare it at the Met Council, but we do it in coordination with TAB, local governments, MnDOT, MAC, PCA, as this is a multimodal plan for the region. And it is updated every 4 years and has public participation of the plan itself, and then a lot of the information that goes into the plan, which is built off of other studies and other plans. It covers all modes, as I've mentioned several times. Highway, transit, bicycle, pedestrian, airport, and freight all have components of the TPP for the region. Updated every 4 years. We are beginning the update of the most recent TPP starting this month, with the expected adoption mid of 2018. It'll cover the same time frame as the current TPP. It'll go out to 2040. So that's more than 20 years looking into the future of investments and policies and plans for the region. It's a plan that's based on forecasts of population, jobs, households, and the best we can understand of how that's going to change over time. It is a fiscally constrained plan, and this is important. It's a plan to implement the investments for the financial resources that we expect over that time frame. It is not a grand vision for what can be for the region. It's a fiscally constrained plan of expected revenue over that time frame. Also, by law, it must demonstrate that we conform to air quality standards with our planned investments over that time frame. The TPP update that we are kicking off is really a fairly modest update. It's really just updating to reflect a lot of work that was done since the last TPP. We've had several key studies that have helped us prioritize high-priority investments in the region that we want to incorporate in the plan. We're recently wrapping up a study that looks at all the principal arterial intersections that are signalized or have, and what would be the priority for maybe changing that operations of those to maybe converting them to freeways or getting rid of those signals with interchanges. The MinPass 3 study, the next round of updating what the priority corridors for MinPass are in the region. We continually do congestion management safety plans, kind of dealing with where we can do strategic investments to improve or reduce congestion and safety. The statewide multimodal plan and the highway investment plan that is led by MnDOT, we make sure that we are in line with what MnDOT is doing through that planning process. We want to look at what the spending is from our local partners, starting a study there. We also have done a lot of work on freight priorities, trying to understand where the priority freight corridors are in the region and what should be some priority investments on those. And lastly, we're currently studying with our regional bike network, where are some of the key barriers that are preventing good linkages of the bike network? As you can see on this slide, some of these studies are led by Met Council. Some of them are led by MnDOT. This is a good example of the partnerships that we have with MnDOT on almost all of these planning processes that then get into the TPP.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to pause 1 second. Mr. Thompson, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. You had mentioned the freight study. I know there's a number of corridors where you have operations that are located in or near freight rail corridors. And there's a study that was just recently updated that the Department of Public Safety does around oil trains, ethanol train safety. Is this a study that you also look at when you're making these kinds of planning decisions?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. Yes, these studies will be incorporated, the lessons and the priorities of the plan. Those planning processes would be incorporated in TPP for freight.
Okay. Thank you. And actually, while I have
Representative Hornstein.
There was a slide just a couple slides ago that I meant to ask a question about. So
sure.
Is the reason that you have air quality as one of the criteria related to non-attainment, federal non-attainment policies? I think our region was very close to that at one time and may still be. And if we are, it would result in hundreds of millions of dollars, I think, in expenditures. Is that kind of why one of the reasons air quality is one of your criteria?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. It is part of our criteria because it's required by federal law. We are currently in maintenance for air quality, so we're expecting to maybe move out of that in the next a few years. So our region is doing well, but it is something we do need to monitor and make investments because it can have a fiscal impact if we have air quality issues.
So in other words, we're not in that danger zone related to attainment anymore?
Madam Chair, members, no.
Okay, that's good news. Thank you.
Representative Bernardi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The regional highway spending study, I'm interested in knowing just a little bit more about that. Is that what's been being spent on regional highways? What's going to be? Is it including what local governments are paying for our highways for different modes of transportation that's not being spent by MnDOT?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, it will include our local partners and what trying to get a understanding of what's being spent on transportation, not just by, for instance, MnDOT or Met Council, but some of our key local partners on major roads.
All right, please proceed, Mr. Thompson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The last update on this slide is that we will, in the TPP update, of course, be updating any fiscal projections should they be, as they have changed since the last update for the next one through 2040. So the other major component is the TIP. That's the we're required to look out 4 years and identify what projects are going to be built within the region that use federal funds. So any project within the region that uses federal funds for the construction of that project must be listed and identified in the TIP. These projects must be consistent with the long-term plan in the TPP. And they also, there are some projects in our TIP is beyond just projects that are federally funded. They include all of MnDOT's projects for the seven-county area, whether they have federal funds or not, and any project that maybe is of significant project that doesn't have federal funds, though most major projects have federal funds in them. The TIP must represent projects that can be built with the available funding that you have. So it is a fiscally constrained plan, just like the TPP.
Okay, and I see we have another question, Mr. Thompson. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I wanted to go back to you don't have to physically go back to the slide, but it mentioned the MnPass, the MnPass 3. So just quickly, how is that determined, the prices? I see that on a very congested day with snowfall of 2 to 4 inches and a thick of ice, which is perfect for skating, it's $5, $6, $7 to use, and then, of course, in the low traffic into. I mean, it's a good business model, but when nothing's going on, it's 10 cents or a nickel. So, who determines the cost, and then how is it determined? Obviously, based on traffic and weather conditions.
Mr. Thompson,
Madam Chair, Representative. Originally, the MnPass system, when it started in 2005, the pricing policy was set by a task force and adopted by the governor. That set the minimum and maximum price of a quarter for a minimum, $8 for maximum trip on a MnPass line. And then within that, the price fluctuates dynamically based on traffic conditions. So as the MnPass lane fills up, the price goes up. As the lane becomes emptier, the price goes down. It's basically a congestion pricing model that is used, and the price is based just on traffic within the MnPass lane itself.
And Madam Chair, if I can add to that, and I'm going to turn to Nick and see if he can help me with this. I think one of the ideas with the pricing is based on being able to maintain a certain speed in that lane.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is true. The goal of the price is to set the price so that the speed of the MnPass lane never drops below 45 miles an hour, so that the users of it, both those paying a toll, a carpool, or a transit rider, always have a guaranteed congestion-free trip on that corridor or in that MnPass lane.
Sir, follow up?
Madam Chair, yeah, just a follow up and I'll move on to that topic. So the business model is good. Of course, if that was my lane, I guess I would think that up it during congestion and weather because you can make more money. But if the purpose is to relieve congestion on the other lanes by having a $7 fee and those who have a MnPass, you're, of course, defeating the objective. You're going to push them back on a congested highway when you have the program to make sure that you can have less congestion for those passengers of one. So in a way, you're making some extra income and revenue, but you're defeating the purposes, at least how I see it and how I drive on it, and pay that exorbitant cost when I
Madam Chair,
feeling rich, Johnson. But sometimes I just get back in congestion and late for the committee.
The Madam Chair, Representative, the actual the purpose of the task is to provide you a congestion-free choice. So it is if you need a congestion-free option, you can pay to use that lane. That's how the pricing is set. So that lane itself has the congestion-free choice that you can make. And it's a choice the consumer makes. If they don't want to pay the price, they can stay in the general purpose lane for free.
Right. And Madam Chair, I'll add one note to that. Particularly in the 35W corridor, we are able to reliably serve about a lane and a half of traffic through our bus system that runs from Lakeville to downtown every day with just the buses that are carrying folks up and down there. So without that advantage, at least through the transit advantage, we would actually have very congested roadways. So providing that as an option and providing the opportunity for that express service to go, we are actually providing relief, or otherwise you'd be sitting in more congestion at that point.
Okay. So, Mr. Thompson, please proceed then.
So, Madam Chair, thank you, members. The one of the key functions of TAB is to deal with the federal allocation of federal funds. The process that is called the regional solicitation. That's the internal process we use. This occurs on average every 2 years, and it's a process where local agencies can apply for the federal funds and compete for the federal funds on a variety of categories. TAB then recommends the slate of projects that are the priority based on the outcome of the competitive process. In general, this is about $100 million a year that is allocated through this competitive process and available to cities, counties, and transportation partners. They allocated in two-year blocks, so the most recent solicitation was about $200 million. These are projects that are led by local governments or regional agencies. It may be it's a priority for a community. It may be a facility that is not a local facility. Example would be a county that advances a trunk highway interchange. But it's a priority for their area, and they solicit federal funds for that project. They fund projects in roadway preservation, modernization, expansion, bridges, transit improvements, modernization, and bicycle and pedestrians, safe routes to school also. It's a very quantitative process that applications are scored. TAB and the staff and TAC and planning, they help develop the criteria. That criteria is updated for every solicitation based on lessons learned, so that we try to make scoring as transparent as possible to everybody involved and eventually lead to a well-supported selection of projects.
Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
I wondered if we could, you said every 2 years, possible to see a list of those projects that received funding in the last go-around?
Madam Chair, members, yes, we can distribute the most recent solicitation and a map of where those projects are that were funded.
All right, great. Thank you.
The outcome of the process has been very geographically balanced across many places, counties and cities, a selection of projects from highway to transit to bicycle and pedestrian. The one other outcome of it is there's a lot of good projects that aren't selected because there's a lot of projects that are submitted for funding, but there's limited funding that can be allocated. These projects receive up to $7 million on some of the projects in federal funds, but they're often matched with local, or they are matched with millions of local dollars also, so to expand the transportation investment.
Mm-hmm. Just a moment, Mr. Thompson. A question, Representative Barr.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One question with regards to the types of projects included in that. You said roadway, bridge, transit, bicycle, pedestrian, and safe routes to school. Is there a required percent amongst those categories? And follow-up to Madam Chair's question, would it be possible to know of those projects that you selected when you send us that list? Could you break it down by that category or at least percentage-wise what went where?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, members, that leads well into this next slide, which I'll talk about. We will provide that information. We do have it broken down by each investment type. If you think of, if you give me pause here, I'll talk about the funding and how how they select what that funding goes towards. So transportation funding itself kind of divide that regional solicitation represents about 3% of the transportation investment in the region over the long term. So it's $200 million every couple of years, but relatively small percentage. However, it is a flexible funding account. TAB decides how that is allocated between roadways, transit, and other. And so there is flexibility in decisions by the TAB to make it more the 200, for in this example, the $200 million to go towards highways, or they can decide to spend a higher percentage towards transit if they desire. That decision is made in advance, with every regional solicitation. They take that total pot of money and decide how they want to allocate that. And so that decision is made by TAB. And in this case, I believe, I don't know the exact percentage of the resource, but the roadways, and then within each category of roadways, they decide, should we spend more on modernization of existing facilities, or should we spend more on expansion, or should we spend more on transportation expansion, transit expansion. So there's all these sub-decisions that are made. This is truly flexible money within that region, but as this slide shows, there's a large percent of the transportation funding for the region is not flexible. It ties back to the funding source itself, be it trunk highway. Trunk highway has restrictions on the investments it can make, so it's not flexible that trunk highway can be invested in transit, for example. So the regional solicitation is a true flexible fund, though it's a small percentage of the investment, if that answers your question.
Mr. Thompson, another question? Representative Uwakem.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. It would be interesting, too, if you got a set list. I know, as in with bonding and all other proposals, you get a lot more solicitations than you can afford to spend money on. So it would be interesting to know, is it like one out of every three projects, or do you have 10 times as many projects as you can fund, just to kind of have that. And then also, since, would there be a project that would choose to go through the flexible funding mount because they can be a little bit more creative with what they want to do and pull money together? Or are some of these solicitations, they're trying for the flexible money, but then they could also fall into the dedicated fund, too, and get money elsewhere?
Mr. Thompson,
Madam Chair,
convoluted.
No, Madam Chair, Representative, that's the questions we get all the time. This most recent solicitation funded roughly one-third of those that were submitted applications. So that's relative. If there was a larger pot of money available, there would have been more applications. People have to decide the highest priorities that they fund. It is not uncommon for a project that does not receive regional solicitation funds to continue forward with other funding sources. I know of a couple projects that did not quite make the cut this year that are being funded at the county level. They've decided it's so important that they need to continue the project. So that does occur. Often these federal funds, they'll help really finalize a deal on a project that it's a great priority. The local partner just hadn't been able to get that last piece, and the federal funding coming in really helps finish the project and get it built.
So, Mr. Thompson, then the last cycle, what would be the dollar amount of the requests that were received and approved here?
Madam Chair, we'll have to get back to the exact dollar amount. We do have that information. I just don't have it with me.
And you had said something about $200 million. That's roughly the
That's roughly what was distributed and okay. Roughly one-third of what was asked, but the specific dollar we can provide.
All right, great. Thank you. Please proceed.
So I've mentioned a few times public participation. We have an official public engagement plan. When we do update the TPP, we have extensive public participation. This is the public's and stakeholders' a very good opportunity to have input on regional transportation planning. You know, a transportation project itself, as it develops in a community, has a very extensive public input and often focuses on those directly affected, maybe be the neighbors or the businesses related near that project. Our public engagement is really about the transportation investments for the region. It's your ability to input all the on input on it. We do it through a variety of methods that are effective, from open houses. We have numerous public hearings. We offer citizens and stakeholders the opportunity at TAB meetings or other council meetings to have public input. As we do individual studies, there's many public input processes in that. So public input occurs at corridor studies, at projects, and then in these regional planning processes. And it's almost continuous through the process.
Okay. A question, Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, would you prefer us to ask questions after their presentation or as they bring up a topic that our as members
No, I think you're fine to go. There's a lot of good stuff we need to answer as we go, I think.
Then regarding your public hearings, once the public hearing is ended, do you then, is there a vote taken based upon action, the course of action, or do you have yet another meeting that in which you'll have the vote, and then at that time are the public invited again? Oftentimes, when I was mayor of Delano, we'd have public input, and we'd have an open house, and we wouldn't take action, but then the following week, we'd take action and vote, and we always wanted to make sure that public had the opportunity to speak at both meetings. So how? What say you?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, it occurs in both ways. If you think about, I'll use an example of the TPP when we do an update. We have multiple public input sessions over a long period of time. Then that creates a draft plan where there's an official public hearing. During that draft planning process over several months, the public hearing, then we have time to record that information. And then eventually when the plan is adopted later on, that is after the public hearing process. But we also have regular meetings where transportation planning is discussed. For instance, TAB, where there's a public hearing, a public input, official public input process at every meeting. And so there might be votes taken at that meeting, but not necessarily related to that public input that occurred as part of the structured agenda for that meeting. But generally, we try to have the public hearings not the same day as a vote on what that public hearing is about. If that answers.
Representative, any follow-up there?
Yeah, just to follow up, and thank you for that clarification. I was just thinking of the, is it Kentwood? Area, they had a lot of public input with the Southwest Light Rail, and I don't think, from what I hear, I'm out in the West, so don't live in Kentwood by any means or that neighborhood, but from what I understand, the public input of that was vehemently against that, and I was just wondering, I would presume with the property tax value in that area, they'd have a pretty important say, but it seems as though the decisions made and their public input was not necessarily resulting in any action other than we're going to put it through anyway.
Madam Chair, Representative, there were robust discussions about the Southwest line and the alignment. The city of Minneapolis provided municipal consent twice for that, and that is a decision for the city to make. And so that came through, and it was adopted, and the line continued forward. So there were many public hearings. I was at many of them. Again, that was but that goes back to where the city then, by statute, has to provide municipal consent, and it was done twice.
Okay. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Thompson and Mr. Shetman, talking about the TPP, and I kind of understand about 2014, about five of the counties did give some critique on the plan back then. What kind of changes were made based on that critique, if any? And I know, kind of going back a couple of years, so maybe Mr. Shetland might remember better, but.
Mr. Shetland. Madam Chair, Representative, I cannot give you something off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to do that. If Arlene were here, she'd be able to rattle it right off for you. She's currently living in Idaho or Oregon or something, so I will follow up with our staff and figure out what that is. I think that's a very fair question, and it's actually a really good question considering we're in the process of updating it now and to see what changed, and I think if it's okay with the committee, we'll have to follow up with you, because I want to give you good information related to that, if that works.
No. Madam Chair, thank you. That would be great if you could forward that to us afterwards, and as long as I have the microphone, just another question. I'm back to the MPO and the governance structure. How does our MAC Council differ from other MPOs across the country in terms of their structure? If you could give us some idea on that. And then are there elected officials more predominant in other MPOs throughout the country that we may, our model may not include?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I mentioned earlier there's 403 different MPOs. There are a variety of structures of MPOs. And some of them, and there's a variety of structures in the state of Minnesota. We have 8 MPOs. So the size of the region that the MPO is responsible is heavily influential about how that MPO is structured. So our model is a different model than some, but I don't think there's any consistent model across about how they're structured. There's some flexibility within that in each region. Sometimes it's all elected officials. Then we have our model, which is a mix of elected officials supporting the Met Council. So there's a variety of options that are out there across the United States.
And Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Shannon?
Just to speak to that a little bit more, the Metropolitan Council serves as the MPO here in this region, but the Met Council is much larger than just the MPO as well, where a number of these other ones that Nick refers to are specifically just that MPO. Mm-hmm. And so they deal only with those federal dollars and that planning dollars that come through, where the council is much broader, where I think it's to our region's advantage that we actually tie the planning that the cities and the counties do as far as how our region is going to grow and plan for that growth and plan for these investments. That is a much better advantage for us, I believe, than what maybe other regions have, where they're just dealing with that specific piece, where we are much closer, I think, on other issues related to land use planning, where we make our investments in wastewater services. You're going to hear about that, I believe it's next Monday, about how we do the planning, how all of this ties back into our regional plan. So the council, I think it's fair to say we are unique, but everybody is unique in how they do that. And we are going back to when we received that designation. Again, this goes back to, I can't remember the date you had earlier in your presentation, but the FTA, this was a question that was asked back in 2010 by many folks, and I think it's FHWA who does that certification came through and recognized the council again, reiterated that the council is the MPO, and then it happened again in 2016. So it's fair to say that we are a legitimate MPO, and that yes, there are questions, but there isn't just basically a rubber stamp of what an MPO is supposed to look like.
Okay, we'll go on to a couple more questions. Representative Uakam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're actually directed to Representative McDonald. If you have a few hours, I'd love to sit down with you and go over the 10 years of open houses, public hearings, corridor management committee, citizens advisory committee, of all those planning and process that went into the Southwest Light Rail Corridor, not just the small Kenwood neighborhood, but Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Edina, Minnetonka, Eden Prairie. I think I still have PTSD from all that, so we could chat anytime you'd like. I'd be more than happy to spend a few hours with you.
Likewise.
Okay, and Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Well, I wasn't going to comment on this, but now that it's on the table. You know, a lot of the concern had to do with the plan changing. You know, it wasn't always going to be co-located with freight. And so I think there was a lot of concern, you know, about that in my area. And so that was not part of the entire 10 years. That was over the last couple. But, Madam Chair, this is really a question for you, and I really appreciate Representative Kosnick's question. Is it your intention that we will be hearing different governance reform or change models in this committee? Just a commercial, I'm going to be doing one to elect the Met Council. People can sign on the jacket shortly. But is it your intention that you would be entertaining different ideas and proposals? I know that the Citizens League has ideas. Others have had different ideas of combinations of, you know, elected officials and appointed officials. We have a staggered terms bill already introduced, I think, that Representative Nash did. Are those going to go to GovOps? Are we going to have a chance to weigh in on them?
Sure.
Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, there's a number of, we're hearing a number of reform bills coming and being drafted and so on. And we will, whether it's one day or 2 days, I guess we will be hearing, you know, all those that I guess come before us.
Fantastic.
So,
thank
yeah.
you.
All right, Mr. Johnson, proceed, please.
So we thought we'd highlight also our partnership with MnDOT. We are closely coordinate the transportation planning process with MnDOT. We consider it a true partnership. in the region. We are jointly participating. Earlier I had mentioned a bunch of studies that were underway that are going to feed the TPP update. Sometimes MnDOT is the lead agency, sometimes we are, but in all those studies we are there in partnership. MnDOT is responsible for the statewide multimodal plan and the statewide highway investment plan. But within MnDOT, they have metro district investment plans, too, also. Metro district encompasses all of the Met Council plus another county. But we make sure that their investment plans and the TPP are in sync. We do this through a variety of ways, but really we are our planners at Met Council and MnDOT are working together monthly, if not weekly, on different projects to ensure that we are coordinating. We do joint system planning, corridor studies, and reports on numerous examples. So I thought we'd close with a few more details about some of the highway, transit, bicycle investment planning that goes with the transportation plan. This is what goes into the TPP. What's going to happen in 2040, and what do we need to plan for with the investment and fiscal constraint that we have? Congestion we have today is expected to get worse. It's even with the investment we have planned. Because we continue to, and positively, we grow as a region, but our transportation system is not growing much. So we expect on our forecast that there will be more congestion. Basically, the map on the left is current congestion. The map on the right is in 2040. The more red it is, the more congested it is. And as you see, it's because of constraint, there is a significant increase in congestion expected throughout the region.
And Mr. Thompson, I'm reading a definition here of congested. So could you just talk us through that? It'd be nice to know, is it something quantifiable?
Yes.
And how do you get to that?
Madam Chair, members, congestion as defined by MnDOT is under 45 miles per hour, and then we break it down into 5-minute increments typically. So congestion, and we can break it out duration, but in this case, experiencing reoccurring congestion and congestion being under 45 miles per hour. Each day on a daily week is different, but over time you start to see patterns of congestion reoccurring.
Very good. Thank you.
So we also need to look at what's happening with demographics. These are key components of what's going to happen in 2040. Population, how many trips people make in a day, how far they're driving, and how large households are, what the number of jobs are. All of these are the components that lead into the transportation planning process. As I mentioned, we continue to grow as a region. We grow in trips, in population. The number of miles people are traveling are growing also. But we're starting to see some different trends out there as demographics change and patterns change. We expect, for instance, that the amount of miles any individual travels is going to decrease over time. So there's patterns changing. We're in a point where there's a lot of things different. Maybe transportation planning was fairly static for a while, but a lot of things are changing in terms of possibly in the region itself. So those are things that we go through a modeling process, trends, state demographer, different inputs to try to forecast this out.
Okay, a couple questions. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the statistic about the decrease in the number of miles traveled. How was that figure arrived at?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, remember, that's a very detailed modeling question, but it's based on some of our forecasters and based on trends. I'd have to get you the exact specifics. I don't have that on hand, but it's a forecast, you know, based on trends and where people live, where they work, and how that is expected to change with land use over time in by 2040. But I can get you more detail if you would like.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, if I could, too. I believe we heard in the testimony a week ago in the joint Senate hearing that, for example, CTIP does not do any studies. And that may be fine, but I'd be interested to know in what studies you're doing. There is something called an origin destination study, and I don't know when the last time it was done, maybe 1990, but it's valuable in terms of knowing where people are moving in great numbers. Right. So I'd be interested in knowing, you know, the results of that or any other studies?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, my council is responsible for maintaining the regional model that forecasts this out, and we do a variety of inputs into that. We do travel behavior studies where we're doing interviews, and then there's regional studies that look at origin destination surveys and sampling over time, done periodic on a routine basis over, not every year. So those are things that we grab statistical samples of models of data from customers that are one component that go into the regional model. And then we have to look at land use patterns, expected economic growth, and other components that would change where jobs are located, where housing is located. All of those are inputs into those forecasts.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think there might be some more interest in that whole subject. So, sure. Representative Hornstein.
Hi, very quick. Do you, with the increase in popularity of these services like Lyft and Uber, car sharing, is that part of your, 2040 projection? And I imagine, does that increase, decrease the number of vehicles on the road? Are you incorporating that in your discussions? And then also, who knows, by then we could have some self-driving vehicles. Not quite sure, how quickly that technology will catch on, but, thinks it will. Some people think it will, some folks not so sure. Are these types of new transportation modes part of the study?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Hornstein. That is where we're at. I mentioned we're at a time of inflection to a lot of things is changing in transportation. And to think about what's happening in 2040 now is a challenge to us. So that is the hot topic, though, in the region. How do you reflect those? And what will be, how many people will own an autonomous vehicle? Will you actually own a car? Those are the things we're trying to understand and understand how we reflect in a model that forecasts our population. We're doing that a couple different ways. We're, for example, studying scenarios on a corridor like 94 to say, well, what if there's a high percentage of people with autonomous vehicles? What would be the traffic impact? So we're trying to learn that through testing different assumptions. But we're probably not at a point now that we have any certainty about that in 2040. But the model continues to update. So as the market gets better understanding, we will update that. And that's why TPP looks out 20 years, but it's updated every four to reflect those changes. But the marketplace is changing fairly rapidly in that we just don't know what the impact will be.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and it could be MnDOT related as well, but I understand that in the metropolitan area, and this may have changed, and I don't know if it's through state aid rules or whatever, that a 20% increase in traffic projection has been what our transportation planning agencies have been planning for as they construct our roadways, which if we now have data that shows in this area anyway it's going to be going down 5%, has that policy been updated so that we're not overbuilding our roads and wasting our dollars?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know about the 20% specifically, but for any transportation project they have to project out, as they're developing alternatives, have to project out what the demand is for the project that they're developing. And so that would reflect the most current projections and assumptions for growth along that specific corridor, and that's tied back into the regional model.
And Madam Chair, just to add to that, I think Representative Bernardi, we're also talking about by 2040 there will be this many more people living in the region, so we're adding additional trips to the current system.
Right.
So that is in addition to the, we're saying there's 800,000 more people going to be living in the region by 2040. Some of those are children, some of those are older folks, but whatever it is, whatever the right calibration is that Nick and his team do, those new folks are in addition to what we have in 2017.
Right.
So just keep that in mind.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll talk with MnDOT afterwards to find out how that 20% of it's changed and what they've been applying, the numbers and that sort of thing. So thank you, and thank you for the work that you guys do.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is just a technical question here, but in looking at the second line there, my math doesn't quite equal how we get from, in daily vehicle trips, 6,600,000 to 9,076,000. and only get 2 million miles changed or whatever. It seems to me that's over 3. So I'm wondering, there must be a typographical error of some sort. Is the change correct or is the 2040 correct? Do we know?
Mr. Thompson, we can always count on Representative Petersburg to find the glitches.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you found our glitch that we put in the presentation. We'll have to follow up. I think that is an error on our slide.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. Do proceed, Mr. Thompson.
That doesn't add. I don't have them either.
So you have your transportation planning, then you have your investment direction. So the region, we're trying to use the fiscal constraint that we have around to strategically invest. As that map showed from 2040, there's going to be a lot of congestion out there. We do not have the, we're not projecting the ability to solve that congestion problem. So how do we best use the transportation funds for the region? Because congestion will be a reality on the system. So we have a hierarchy of processes that we go through to try to do as much across the region to invest to deal with congestion as or mobility. First of all, are there technologies, transportation management strategies, which are very low cost, that can be applied on a corridor that's congested to maybe either delay the need for a bigger investment or solve or really reduce congestion? Example would be traffic signal timing on an arterial, ramp metering, traveler information systems. The next step after that, if that does not solve your congestion, you can do spot mobility improvements. These are highly effective, low-cost investments. They may be an auxiliary lane between interchanges, a new type of access or change in access, or some sort of investment of that nature that are very low-cost. The step after that is to add a MinPass lane to a corridor to provide a choice for users on that corridor. MinPass, now we're moving into an expansion. MinPass is an expansion on a highway corridor. The first few MinPass lanes were converting HOV lanes that were already there. Now as we add MinPass, we're adding a lane to that corridor. But it's a strategy that allows you to say, we're going to invest in MinPass. This will ensure that there's a congestion-free choice on that corridor, not just when MinPass lane opens, but long-term, because you're managing that lane with pricing. A typical lane that you would invest in, there's no guarantee that 2 years later a general-purpose lane is not congested again. And so MinPass is a long-term strategy for choice in that corridor. And then lastly, there are some times that you get to the last step, major strategic capacity, to maybe complete a system. Example would be Highway 610, which we just completed the connection to 94, or some major expansion of a system interchange. But these are typically very high cost projects when you get to strategic capacity expansion.
I'll ask you to hold 1 second, Mr. Thompson. Representative Kosnick.
Chair Rumbuck, thank you. In regards to the MinPass lane, can you speak to the times on it? I believe it's 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. And if the idea is to make money, that's great. I think it's not. I think the main objective is to relieve capacity. How much consideration has been done to minimize that window of time to be more congruent to the rush hour congestion peaks? Meaning, if we shorten it to 9:30 or 9, I think we'd have 3 lanes going through the interstate in my area. And something that I'd like, and starting at 6 o'clock, I don't think the rush hour starts quite then. I recognize in other areas, and it could in the future, but at this point, and who has jurisdiction over that, how to adjust that? Thank you.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the jurisdiction question, these are hours that are set by MnDOT and with agreement by Federal Highway Administration when it's on an interstate or trunk highway. The hours themselves are set a little bit different by corridor so far. They're trying to match up, as I understand, the MnDOT policy with the congestion levels on that specific corridor, recognizing that corridors are different, have different peaks. Sometimes it's just in the AM peak direction. Sometimes it's AM and PM, depending on the corridor. And one of the strategies of setting the hours is to set it beyond the traditional peak period, because the peak shifts over time, It shifts from day to day, maybe with weather, so that whenever the hours are set, it's trying to be any time that congestion may occur, there's that the pricing is occurring at that time. So there's options. So it's some flexibility around the traditional peak. And really, it's hours set today are for the long term. So a peak period today might look very different 10 years from now as growth occurs in the region.
A follow-up, Representative Posner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a quick follow-up on that, and the folks at MnDOT are probably listening. You know, we've asked for a third lane going south through Lakeville. We're told that the congestion isn't consistent enough throughout the day. So I think there may be some contradiction here. If we can minimize the time of that min-pass time, maybe we will prove MnDOT right then have a little less congestion.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I understand your question, it's a current, the place where there's a current min-pass lane or a future?
Current.
Okay. I'm not familiar exactly with the current operation out there, but that'd be a better question for MnDOT.
And Madam Chair and Representative Posnick, as a Lakeville resident as well and live around the corner from you, yes, I understand what you're talking about, and we'll have that conversation with MnDOT as well. But those are all good points that your predecessor, former Ways and Means Chair and Transportation Chair, Representative Holberg and Commissioner Holberg would raise as well. So we will we'll have that conversation with MnDOT.
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while you're having that conversation, be sure to include the situation from Long Lake to 494 as well. That's unnecessary and starts too early. My question is with regard to MnPass, that these lanes are constructed, you know, with our dollars, federal dollars, in which all users of transit, transportation, cars and whatnot pay for. Why, what's the philosophy, what's the rationale that only people with extra money to pay a premium are permitted to have easy access or easier access into town?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the philosophy behind it is to provide, there's a tremendous demand for a few things. Congestion in a corridor, the demand is to expand that corridor. As we can see with fiscal constraint, we have limited funds to do expansion. If we do strategic expansion like MnPass, we want to make sure that that reason we're doing congestion is there for the long term, that there's a congestion-free option for that. So MnPass allows that for any user that wants to have a congestion-free option. But it also not the majority of the users of MnPass are not paying for MnPass because they are a carpool or a transit rider. Those riders are not paying a toll to use the MnPass lane, and they are, I think the numbers I've most recently seen from 394 and 35W, the majority of users of MnPass are either a carpooler or a transit rider, so the majority of them are not paying the toll and are not required to pay the toll because they are one of those two users.
Okay. All right. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Recently I was talking to a woman from Apple Valley who said she now has to leave at 5:30 in the morning to get to her job at the U. So she is really concerned about getting into the Twin Cities from that area. But I guess what I am totally amazed about, and I take 35E quite a bit, there is so much stop and go, and I'm just amazed. And I don't get a whole lot of complaints. I'm just amazed at how people accept this. And just wondering, maybe they're complaining to other people, but they're certainly not complaining to me. And there's a lot of traffic on 35E.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's a lot of traffic out there, I agree, and there's we do hear complaints, but there is, you know, people get used to things too. And so you know, we have congestion levels out there that are as bad as other regions. And it's congestion caused by lack of capacity, by days like today when it snows, by our construction season. And I know some of, I guess, have just accepted it, but others, we definitely hear from some who think it's too bad. It's not, it should be resolved.
Just, you know, I think our drivers are really to be commended because it is challenging if you're out there in rush hour, no question.
Okay, Mr. Thompson, then I want to proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. the map you see before you is the fiscally constrained plan for the region, the highway investment plan. These are identified in MnDOT's Metro District Work Plan also. And the map is just looking at the MnDOT trunk highway projects. Obviously, the counties and cities have quite a few transportation projects that they'll develop too. But you see that there's investment occurring throughout the region. If you were to map this map against that congestion map, though, you'd see several corridors that are congested that are not seeing major investment planned because in the fiscal constraint scenario. So the next mode, transit planning, design performance, again, this goes into the TPP, transit ways and how we develop transit ways through a data-driven approach. We use performance standards to evaluate which routes should be invested in, which routes maybe should change, how frequent routes service is on an existing route. And we're always doing that on a continuous basis. That's almost an operations planning function. Looking at annually, how is our transit system performing on a route-by-route basis? Where can we make it more efficient? Where is service needed? Where can we change our service to better serve the customer? We do that by looking at the transit market areas. Transit is not provided in the entire region, so we're trying to have transit where it makes most sense to be most efficient. One of our planning tools is our transit market areas, and this map here kind of looks at different transit viability by market area. The darker center area has more viable transit systems.
And I have a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the discussion. I think from the information I've heard over the last few years, transit seems to be the one area in which there is the most complexity in both the operations as well as the planning stages of it. Last week we heard from Commissioner McLaughlin about CTIP and about how they provide the funding mechanism, and it talked about it specifically in regards to light rail transit systems, and how Met Council is responsible for operation and planning, but a whole different mechanism is responsible for funding it and so forth. And yet there's no one in the middle there that's talking about is there any need or consequence for performance. Now, let me give you an example. With light rail transit system, according to what we heard last week, during the construction phase, about 50% of the cost comes from federal government, about 30% comes from CTIB, 10% comes from the state and maybe a little bit from Met Council, and 10% comes from the counties through property taxes and so forth. So the construction is all covered there. In regards to the operation, then anything that is outside of either the federal funding or the fare box, 50% of it is paid for by CTIB and 50% by the state legislature, by statute. Mm-hmm. Nothing in there would really help us to figure out ways of being more efficient or provide cost of ridership, et cetera. And Mr. Shedden, last year when I asked about when fares were last raised, it was 2008. Well, it's no fault of Met Council. There's no need to, because all the cost overages and so forth are borne by taxpayers in other areas. So I think your previous slide where it talked about performance, design and performance, we really haven't put anything in statute or in any kind of rules regulation that really would enable or promote determining what is the best cost-effective pricing and how we get performance, etc. I mean, we have to take into consideration low income and all that stuff. I understand that. But there are a lot of other people that don't fit within that category that certainly ought to be looking at higher rates as well. And if we're looking at performance and shortage of transit options in the future, don't we have to be looking at the whole gamut of not only how we get corridors put in place, but how they perform and whether or not we can sustain them in the future?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, remember, there's a lot of questions within that, but yes, let me go to the transit way planning slide. This might help me frame the answer to that question. To talk about how a transit way is developed from the start to operations, and then the process that looks at efficiency through that. So We have several transit ways under development at this point. The key part is they start at the local planning process. They are not started by Met Council. They're started through the local planning, local agencies that are leading the planning process. And in typically, it's example, the Gold Line to Washington County, Washington County Regional Rail, leading that process in the planning process. And through that process, they're looking at a variety of alternatives, to from no build to light rail to other transit products that could be delivered to meet the needs in that corridor, whatever corridor that is. And they look in that planning process to develop an alternative, the preferred locally preferred alternative, that efficiency is one of the measures they look at. Which ones will have the best ridership, the most cost-effective ridership? That's one of the elements that is considered. It's not the only element. And at the end of that local-generated process, they have a locally preferred alternative, the alternative that goes into the project development, engineering, construction phase, which we are on some projects. And that's where Met Council takes over and says, the local agencies have determined that this is the alternative they would like developed. Then we, in that project development and engineering, we try to find the most effective ways to manage cost, keep it cost effective, to do things that gets the most ridership on that, most efficient ridership, and at that eventually you ask for those federal funds, the 50% federal funds. You are then competing against many other transit projects across the country. And efficiency of your operations is one of the measures that you're kind of trying to compete with. So you're trying to drive efficiency into the development of that project through your fare structure, your connecting services, the cost of the project, so that and the end product that is built is more competitive than any of these other projects, not just in our region, but around the country to receive those federal funds. Different types of transit ways have different efficiencies. There's no doubt. Different corridors have different efficiencies for the same mode based on different how development patterns exist around there. And then after it's operational, we are measuring efficiency through how much revenue is collected from fares, what the cost of operations are, and decisions are being made about level of service to drive up to make those routes very efficient. The fare box question and the fare structure is a different question. And maybe, Judd, you want to answer?
Sure.
Related to where we're moving with that.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg. We did have that conversation about fare box recovery, and we've stated in the past that the council has a goal that we'd like to get our fare box recovery ratio around the 28% to 30% range, which is a little bit higher than the industry average. And actually, right now, the council is in the process of going. I'm trying not to get ahead of myself here, but we are in the process of looking what going through the process of raising fares would be. And so, don't quote me on that. But we are in the process of starting. There is actually a federal process that we have to follow since we receive federal funds that we have to follow in order to go through many public hearings, look at different options as far as what you would do as far as the fare increase, because one of the impacts of a fare increase is that we have a reduction in ridership when we raise fares, and it takes about 18 months to 24 years to get that ridership back. But just as a heads up to the committee, we are in the process of looking at beginning that federal process.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and thank you for that clarification, and I don't doubt that you are. Look at the presentation that you have up there. We're really good about the planning stages up to getting it being built, and then we never really talk about the ongoing need for evaluation and determination and so forth. And it's nice to know that you're doing some things like that. But you know, we do have to continue moving forward. And just because we're at industry norms or not, it depends upon our system. And each one of us have to make that decision on all programs. So thank you for that clarification.
And just to add one more point to that, Madam Chair, Representative Rumbach and Representative Petersburg, back in 2011, when we negotiated the transportation budget, we settled on some language that ultimately became the guideway status report that is conducted by MnDOT. And as part of that, Met Council works with MnDOT to provide a report to the legislature about all of these guideways that are in our long-range plan that talk about the capital costs, the future operating costs, and we do that and provided that to the legislature last November. We're in the process of updating that right now, and we will have that for the legislature this November as well. So just want to make the point that we do provide that information. It's actually required by the legislature. Representative Beard and at the time Senator Gimsey had asked for that. I think the Minnesota Chamber, I see Bentley in the crowd, or he was in the crowd earlier, brought that forward. And we ultimately agreed that there should be some additional review of what the state may be required to fund when we look at the long-range funding, the costs of these investments. And we agreed, and so we do put that out, and this will be our, I think, fourth version of that here this fall.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. I'm not sure exactly where Representative Peterson was going, but I can tell you I used to serve on the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority Board. And before the change was made, we knew for sure that there were a number of people from Lakeville that were using our services, but Lakeville would never join into the program. But yet, on the other hand, it's really hard to say, okay, the people from Lakeville are going to pay $5 extra because we're not getting anything from the city. I mean, we're working really hard to have a transit system that works for everybody. But there are a lot of inequities, no question. Yeah.
And Madam Chair,
Mr. Shetland,
and Representative Mason, and just so you know, back in 2008, Lakeville did come into the taxing district, they are now paying. There are communities outside of there that are not in the taxing district, but much of our system is funded through the motor vehicle sales tax, which is a statewide fund. So everybody does participate in paying and providing funds to MnDOT through MVEST and to the Metro Transit for MVEST. The suburban providers receive a piece of that as well. But when we negotiated the urban partnership agreement back in 2008, Lakeville did join at that point. So just so you know that tension has been relieved.
I am well aware of that.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Great.
Representative Horstein.
Thanks. And Lakeville loves the prospect of the Gold Line. Or not the Orange Line, sorry. Woodbury likes the prospect of the Gold Line. I have a question, Madam Chair. It relates to Representative Petersburg's questions around fare box recovery. I seem to recall that when the legislative auditor looked at transit governance, there was a table in the report, and I couldn't pull it up now, but I think it ranked the Met Council second and maybe to San Diego, if I'm recalling correctly, in terms of efficiency with fare box recovery. But that report's now like at least maybe 3 years old. Yeah. Has the Met Council held its position and ranking on that since then? Do you know?
Mr. Shetland?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, we are not quite at the same level that we were at that point, and that is one of the reasons why we're looking at potentially raising fares in order to make sure that the fare box pays its share of the operating cost. Again, there's going to be a robust process that we have to go through to do that, but our fare box recovery level has dropped a bit since the 2010 report. And so that is one of the things that we are
2010,
considering.
Wow, that was longer than I thought.
It came out in December 2010, Madam Chair, and we did all the hearings on it in January of 2011.
Okay.
And since.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. All right, so a couple more slides to go, and we'll see if we have any other questions from the members.
So I'm on slide.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to ask you to hang on. Representative Bernardi, did you have a question?
Well, I did, and I it was regarding Representative Hornstein asked part of it, but I was just wondering, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, we don't have a lot of transportation dollars. It's important to have people on buses, especially right now, and in
light rail so that we can keep people off the other roadway so people who are traveling by car can have a better way about. What is there anything that we should be weighing in on this, other than the legislature in this conversation, or be worried about if the fare increases do go up in the short term and maybe in the long term for policy implications and just more congestions and on our roadway, or not getting workers to employment and employers getting their workers to their jobs?
Who would like that one?
The
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative. If there is a fare increase, it will have an impact on the transportation system. At least in the short term, there will be fewer riders on transit as a result of it. It will affect the riders that some of them, it's a pocketbook issue for some of the riders. So we will be able to forecast what the impact is on ridership based on a fare increase. We won't be able to necessarily do it route by route, I don't think, but we'll be able to share that information. You'll be able to, based on that information, you can make a decision about how you want to weigh in. But that process is a very public process, and there's very good models about projecting the impacts of fare increase on ridership.
Okay, Representative Bernardi. Madam Chair, I guess my question was a little bit more expansive. Is you have, like, sounds like good data on ridership, but what is that the impact on the rest of our transportation systems? Are you able to share that with us, or what ought we be considering?
Madam Chair, Representative, so if there's a decrease in ridership, those riders go somewhere. Either they go to a highway mode if they have that option. Some of the trips are no longer able to make. So some people maybe cannot get to their place of employment on a regular basis, or school, for example. It impacts, has broad implications for the users of the transit system. And, you know, it will reduce ridership, and those trips, still, most of them still need to be made somehow or in a different manner. So there's implications to consider.
Madam Chair, just to put a more general blanket over this, and we talked about this, I believe, last week in our joint session overview, but 80% of the people who ride our system are riding to get to a school or to go to work, and if they're going to school, they're hopefully going to graduate so they can eventually go to work. And so your point is well taken, that yes, there is an impact, and that is something that we certainly have to keep in mind. We also do believe that the fare box has to participate in the cost of providing the service, and those are the things that we need to really consider when we bring forward the potential for a fare increase. And I can't stress enough that this is going to be a very public process if it happens, and so we will be able to provide the committee and the Transportation Finance Committee much more detail about that process here as we go. But your points are very good, and I understand your perspective, and I think if we start undertaking that process, that we will certainly be back before the committee to kind of flesh that out for everyone.
Okay.
And the impacts of it for everyone.
Okay. So, Mr. Thompson, a couple more slides to go.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So our transitway investment plan includes four LRT and BRT corridors that are in various phases of project development. The green line and orange line enter the construction stage this year, and blue line follows shortly after in the plan process. And the gold line just completed its locally preferred alternative, so it's transitioning now to the project development phase, so transitioning from the local stage to Met Council leading the next stage of project development. Those are all within our transitway investment plan. And then we also have arterial BRT projects. The most recent to open was on the A line, which runs from Rosedale and Snelling Avenue down to the Hiawatha line.
And Mr. Thompson, what would be the difference between that? I mean, why is that within, well, is that not a Metro Transit project, the arterial BRT? Because it's a bus.
Correct, Madam Chair. That is a Metro Transit service. Metro Transit provides that service and has been developing those lines. But they are local bus, more local bus in nature than these transitway, other transitway projects.
All right, thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Thompson.
Here's a map of the transitways in the region, both existing and planned. This includes commuter rail, light rail, and bus rapid transit. BRT examples that we have, besides the A line, we have the red line running from Apple Valley to the Mall of America. That has been in operation since 2013, and as I mentioned, the orange line is about to enter construction this year.
Mr. Thompson, I have a question here. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Chair Rombeck. Can you just very briefly, just to clarify how you define the differences in the, your arterial and then the BRT lines, and then have a follow-up question in regards to the planned funding and on that. Thank you.
Mr. Thompson.
So, Madam Chair, member, so the different tiers of transitways here is we have the commuter line, which is the North Star line, the heavy rail, longer distance in nature, fewer stops. Then we have the LRT systems, like the green line outside the Capitol here. And then the next kind of stage down is like the red line, which is a BRT system. Part of that is on the freeway. Part of that is on an arterial. So these services have frequent service, reliable, every 15-minute service for the LRT and the BRT. They have off-platform pay, so you pay before you get on the transit system, very similar between BRT, LRT, and commuter rail on that. The arterial BRT is on Selling Avenue. That is an off-platform payment, just like LRT, but it's often operated in traffic with the general traffic on it. A slower speed road like a Snelling Avenue maybe is 30 miles per hour. So there's a little different flavor, but they have a lot of commonality in terms of frequency of service, payment systems. They're just different tiers depending on the transit way itself, if that answers your question.
Representative
Pascal. Madam Chair, thank you. Is there a difference in the subsidy or the funding difference between arterial busing and, what do you call the BRT or express?
BRT.
Mr. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, is highway BRT or BRT versus arterial BRT, which is more on a local road or our Snelling Avenue, mm-hmm. for instance. I think the difference in funding on the transitways, the bigger transitways, where are the County Transit Improvement Board, they pay 50% of the operating costs after the fare box is taken off the top, and that goes down to the North Star, Green Line, Blue Line, trying to think what else, the Red Line, and the express service from Lakeville to downtown. But then the other local service is funded through Metro Transit or else the suburban provider.
The other element I can add to that is the federal programs are different by project size, too. Right. So there are the larger projects often fall in what is called the New Starts program. So they have different planning and regulations, those that are larger, like the Green Line. And the Orange Line would be an example of a Small Starts project, which is a different federal program, different requirements and different funding level. And you're competing against a different type of project for that federal funds.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Kosnick. So the highway projects, the Orange Lines, Red Lines, local counties are providing some of the subsidy on that. On the arterial, a little bit faster, but they, am I correct in understanding that they also have regular bus routes on that?
Mr. Shetnin?
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, yes, there is additional local service, but that service has been scaled back significantly, where you're seeing now that the arterial service that isn't stopping at every corner is moving through that corridor much faster. And one of the outcomes that we've seen just since opening that that service in June, that we're seeing a 33% increase in ridership because we're able to move folks from Roseville, potentially connect to the Green Line, head down Snelling, take a right on Ford Parkway, and then connect to the Green Line. We've seen a 33% increase in our ridership through that. And in our long-range plan, I think it's important for the committee to understand that most of the investments that we're trying to make are in bus. Very few of the transitways that we are looking to invest in are rail. Most of them are bus. 17 of the 20, in fact, are investments in busing, and many of those are arterial BRTs as well.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
So I'm looking at some of the capital transit, Met Council capital program transit. We've got some funding here for arterial lines A to J in going out to 2020. So do you have lines predetermined for that and the funding placeholders on that? And then conversely, looking at the highway, the BRTs, significantly less funded appropriated there. So if you could comment on that, that'd be great.
Mr. Thompson?
Sure. I'll take a stab at that, Madam Chair, Representative. So you can't quite maybe not see it well on the map, but the A through J are on the map in very light blue. It might not show up real well, but these are sequenced in different stages of funding. The highway BRT, the red line, is basically finishing. It has a few projects related to it still, even though it's in operation, is still has some projects that are to complete it. And the orange line is basically almost fully funded and would start construction this year. So for that, and then gold line is seeking some state, the governor's proposal has some money for that, and then there's local money to enter the project development phase for that dedicated BRT system to Washington.
And Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, yes, you're seeing those many of those arterial projects planned, but they're not funded. Mm-hmm. So we have the A line that's funded and up and operating right now. We have a budget plan that we're bringing forward in order to fund these and have that conversation with the legislature. These are what we look at as our long-range plan, and what we would be able to do, we think, is with efficiently using investment dollars that we'd receive for our broader system and investing in projects like the gold line and the orange line and these arterial BRTs. The point I was trying to make earlier is that many of those investments that we're trying to make are recognizing that in many of those corridors, investing in bus is the best way to do that. And that goes back to the slide that Nick showed you a little bit ago about the planning process, where it starts with the locals. It starts with them, and then we look at alternatives analysis, or they do a feasibility study, alternatives analysis, and then it's a locally preferred alternative, which is adopted by those locals, and then it is turned over and comes over to the council as a project, and either goes into the small starts pot of dollars, or it goes into the new starts pot of dollars, which is the much bigger type project. So we are doing the planning for all of these all throughout this process, and then they get put into effect once the funding becomes available. And projects like the Orange Line have received funding in a variety of ways, but you're correct. Dakota County is participating. Hennepin County is participating. CTIB is participating. The state has participated to a certain point. We still need some additional dollars from the state to complete that. But all of these projects that you see in here as far as the transitways have that element to them. And until we find a different way to fund them, you see them as planned until we're able to move them into programs.
Any follow up?
One other follow up. Thank you for that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of on a related note, the express buses and the BRT lines or arterials, for lack of to differentiate it from local bus routes. We have the MAC in here, the Metropolitan Airports Council in here, and we talked a little bit about busing going into the airports to relieve congestion. Can you talk a little bit about busing into the airport, what your thoughts and visions are on that? Are buses not allowed in there? I understand they're bigger and whatever, but if that's an opportunity to relieve some congestion and to do it with more of an express service. Thank you.
And Mr. Shetland, I think you have about 30 seconds for this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kosnick, we currently do have bus service that goes into the airport. It's the local 54 route. That route runs, it's one of our high-speed routes. It runs along West 7th Avenue from St. Paul to the airport. We also have a light rail line that services the airport as well with its own dedicated stop. But the if the question you're asking is if we can have additional service that would go to the airport, we're in a preservation and maintenance budget mode right now. And so that is a conversation that we'd like to have with the legislature about what we could do with some additional service. But we currently do service it through a local route and through light rail, but which are also able to connect through the Green Line or North Star or however you want to get there. But as far as express bus service to the airport, we're just not in a position to be able to provide that at this point.
All right, very good. I guess there's one page left of the presentation, but we could all read it. How about that?
Thank you, Madam Chair,
thank
for
you
the
very
opportunity
much,
to be
gentlemen.
Here today.
I appreciate a very good presentation.
Great.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.